Chapter 6 Insight with a capital I. The Sutra. I am, O Lord, the one whom the Tathagata, the Arhat, the fully enlightened one, has pointed out as the foremost of those who dwell in peace. I am, O Lord, an Arhat free from greed. And yet, O Lord, it does not occur to me, an Arhat am I, and free from greed. If, O Lord, it could occur to me that I have attained arhatship, then the Tathagata would not have declared of me that Subhuti, this son of good family, who is the foremost of those who dwell in peace, does not dwell anywhere. That is why he is called a dweller in peace, a dweller in peace. It is not that as an arhat Subhuti is not aware of being an arhat, but although he is aware of being an arhat, he is, at the same time, not conscious of it. He does not see it as an object, so there is no question of his making it an object of grasping. If he has to present it to other people as an object which he has attained, he does so only to conform to linguistic usage. He does not really think or feel himself that he has attained to anything at all in that way, which is why he has attained it. The idea of testifying to your attainment is clearly a risky procedure. It does, however, seem to have become expected in certain traditions, almost as a matter of politeness, to announce one's spiritual grade. In the Zen tradition, this is taken to extremes. At the end of a retreat, the master announces the names of all the good boys who have attained Kensho, and they go to the top of the class. Sometimes they even get certificates. It is difficult to refer to one's personal spiritual attainment or insight naturally and unselfconsciously without appropriating it or exploiting it in some subtle way. Recognizing this, the central Buddhist tradition encourages a healthy reticence. If you are observing silence or celibacy or fasting or indeed any practice, it is absolutely crucial to the practice that it be performed in a cheerful and easy-going manner. The point is that if you grasp too strongly at a spiritual state, what you are grasping at is not a spiritual state at all. You just cannot have a possessive attitude towards even the concept of enlightenment. To insist on your attainment too strongly is clear proof that you haven't got it at all. Robert Burns satirizes an extreme example of this serious spiritual defect within what is obviously quite a warped tradition anyway in his famous poem Holy Willie's Prayer, which purports to represent the grateful orisons of a Scottish Calvinist that he is so much more pious than other men, barring a few minor slips into drunkenness and fornication. But if we are here slating spiritual pride, where does the positive quality of Buddha pride fit in? The simple answer is that it is a Vajrayanic concept. Inasmuch as the Vajrayana presupposes the Mahayana, and as, technically speaking, the whole of the Vajrayana takes place within the last of the 10 bhumis, or grounds, of the Bodhisattva's progress, so any specifically Vajrayanic idea applies only to a fully-fledged Bodhisattva. At that level, Buddha pride is an unself-conscious awareness of belonging to the Buddha family and a natural feeling for how to behave in a way that is appropriate to a member of that family. Actually, however, within the Buddha family, the idea is inapplicable, strictly speaking, as there is literally no question of behaving inappropriately. There is here no conflict or even distinction between desire and duty. When Subhuti says that he is one the Buddha has pointed out as the foremost of those who dwell in peace, he is alluding to a well-known passage in the Anguttara Nikaya of the Pali Canon, in which the Buddha praises each one of his 80 foremost disciples for the particular quality or achievement in which they are foremost. It would seem from this that as people develop, they become more individual, more distinctive in their abilities and endowments. Buddhist art quite often failed to do justice to this efflorescence of individual talents and qualities within the Sangha. Monks are depicted around the figure of the Buddha as little rubber stamp miniature versions of him, minus the Ushnisha, not an impression that is borne out by the scriptures themselves. Now, bodhisattvas, as opposed to arhats, are expected to develop some versatility, but it has to be said that even the Buddha was not good at everything. The thousand arms of Avalokiteshvara, each with its weapon, tool, or emblem, depict the Sangha in its diversity of skills, as well as the diversity of skills required of each bodhisattva. They represent the ideal of cooperation, of abilities working together and complementing one another, as opposed to people jostling to be top dog and insisting that their own field of endeavour has a much greater weight or distinction than the unimportant things that other people get up to. Among the eminent company of the Buddha's disciples, with all their individual attributes, there was clearly no shortage of possible deuteragonists for the Diamond Sutra. The obvious person to play the leading role with the Buddha would have been Shariputra, foremost in wisdom. But this wisdom in which he is so preeminent is the intellectual, analytical wisdom of the Abhidharma, rather than the transcendental wisdom of the Prajnaparamita. So instead, the compiler, if we may designate the author or authors in this historical way, of the Diamond Sutra, names Subhuti as the disciple best equipped to receive the perfection of wisdom. Subhuti became an arhat, the Anguttara Nikaya tells us, on the basis of, which is not necessarily, of course, by means of, his practice of the Metta Bhavana, the meditation in which he develops universal loving-kindness. The Buddha also commends him as one who, quote, teaching the Dharma without distinction and limitation, is the chief of those who live remote and at peace, unquote. Remote and at peace translates the word arana, which is the negative form of the term rana, meaning violence. But it also suggests the word aranya, or forest, which carries the connotation of remoteness, which is possibly why it is used instead of the more strictly positive term for peace, shanti. The combination of qualities that Subhuti embodies is suggestive of the bodhisattva ideal more than of the arhat ideal, the arhat ideal as conceived by the Mahayana, that is, and in the Diamond Sutra he comes across as quite the Mahayanist. The Lord asked, "What do you think, Subhuti? Is there any Dharma which the Tathagata has learnt from Dipankara, the Tathagata, the Arhat, the fully enlightened one?" Subhuti replied, "Not so, O Lord, there is not." According to tradition, the Buddha-to-be, then called Sumedha, as a disciple of the 24th Buddha previous to him, Dipankara, was assured by Dipankara of ultimate Buddhahood. What the Diamond Sutra is saying, however, is that nothing at all took place between Dipankara and Sumedha, and that the great succession of Buddhas in which Dipankara describes his own disciple is empty. In other words, strictly speaking, there is no such thing as Buddhist tradition in any literal sense. There isn't a deposit of truth, as the Bible is called by some Protestants, delivered for all time to the faithful and simply handed down from generation to generation, even if the Theravadins do sometimes think of the Pali Canon in this way. Buddhism is not a revealed religion in this sense. It does involve revelation in the sense that all knowledge is a species of revelation, but there is not some thing which is revealed and then passed on unchanged. In this regard, even the Zen insistence on the concept of transmission, Zen being traditionally defined as a special transmission outside the scriptures, can be misleading. No doubt the best Zen masters interpret this key concept precisely as a succession based on having your understanding verified by someone who has had their understanding verified, and so on, all the way back to the Buddha. But there is no doubt also that many Zen students do conceive of this transmission in quite literal, even materialistic terms, and this despite the fact that the Diamond Sutra is especially cherished by the Zen tradition. A cultural tradition there may be, but not a spiritual tradition, if by this we mean some unchanging thing actually handed on or transmitted, like a precious vase passed down from generation to generation until someone drops it. The only satisfactory image for the Buddha's transmission would be a relay of flaming torches, some flickering, some dwindling to a spark, and some blazing and roaring, but all capable of lighting the next torch. Another simpler way to explain it is just to say that what the Buddha reveals is himself, and in doing so he inspires the disciple into being his own enlightened self. The Lord said, "If any bodhisattva would say, 'I will create harmonious Buddha fields,' he would speak falsely. And why? The harmonies of Buddha fields, the harmonies of Buddha fields. Subhuti, as no harmonies have they been taught by the Tathagata. Therefore he spoke of harmonious Buddha fields." A bodhisattva speaking of creating harmonious Buddha fields would speak falsely, just as a musician becoming too conscious of the beautiful music he is playing is apt to strike a false note. A good performance depends on the complete absorption of the player in the music, with no such lapses in concentration. The same goes for one practice of meditation, as you may know from your own experience. If in the middle of meditating you suddenly think, "Gosh, I'm really getting on well today, really concentrated. Oh yes, I'm really getting into it. Hardly any thoughts there at all." Well, there goes your meditation. On an infinitely loftier, transcendental level, the same goes for being a bodhisattva and creating Buddha fields. These are fields of influence within each of which a Buddha is personally responsible for the spiritual evolution of the inhabitants. Whether you are meditating or creating Buddha fields, you can only do it successfully if you do it naturally and spontaneously. What, however, is actually being created when, by the perfection of skillful means, you create a Buddha field? What is its ontological status? In what sense can it be said to exist? What is it? Khonsa pronounces it to be no material or perceptible fact in reality, no more than a mental construction. Buddhist tradition, on the other hand, does represent it as actually existing in exactly the same way as this world exists, equally material, equally perceptible, and at the same time equally void. Looking at it the other way round, this world itself is no less of a mental construction than a Buddha field or Pure Land is, although we perceive it as real, as existing. The only distinction to be drawn between them is that a Buddha field is more archetypal, and from a relative standpoint, nearer to reality, nearer to the transcendental, than is this world of ours, inasmuch as from this world, the Kama Loka, you have to pass through the Rupa Loka and the Arupa Loka to arrive at the transcendental. If, therefore, worlds were to be classified into three ontological categories, the absolutely real, the relatively real, and the apparent or illusory, Buddha fields would come into the second one. If you were in a Buddha field, you would experience it as you experience this world, as a spatial reality. In an absolute sense, however, a Buddha field is no nearer to reality than this world is, because, in an absolute sense, the conditioned in any form is infinitely remote from the unconditioned. But can we accept the impression we get from many Buddhist texts, an impression which Khonsa himself does not examine, that bodhisattvas work all on their own to set up Buddha fields, creating them entirely out of their own merits, so that a lot of other beings can come along afterwards and inhabit them? Can a bodhisattva establish his or her own Buddha field irrespective of what other beings are up to? No. On the contrary, your rebirth depends on the spiritual choices you yourself have made, on your own spiritual evolution, which must contribute to the quality of the Buddha field in which you arrive. Bearing in mind that Khonsa warns us not to press too closely the idea of a bodhisattva creating a Buddha field, as the Sanskrit nishpadayati means also accomplish, perfect, achieve, ripen, and mature, it would surely seem that what brings you to one Buddha field rather than another is a strong connection with the bodhisattva responsible for establishing that Buddha field. So, from a certain stage, maybe even from the initial stage, the bodhisattva is most probably working in successive lives with a host of other beings. And when the bodhisattva does eventually come to establish the Buddha field in which they are all born, he or she does so in conjunction with them. The Buddha of a Buddha field has simply taken the leading part in its creation. This supposition fits well with Buddhist tradition. In the Jataka tales, the same group of people, Devadatta, Rahula, Ananda, and the rest, are reborn with the Buddha-to-be time after time, or rather lifetime after lifetime. When he becomes enlightened, they all turn up as his disciples, and all, except Devadatta, become enlightened after him. So in the context of the Hinayana, you have the concept of a whole group of people under the leadership of one powerful personality traversing life after life together until they eventually emerge in the world in their last lives of all and gain enlightenment altogether. The Mahayana version of this sodality is of a group of beings being reborn again and again in different worlds, even in different world systems, but always together, and ending up in a world of their own, as it were, one which they have created by their joint efforts. And unlike the Hinayana idea of the world you end up in, which is this impure one, the world which, according to the Mahayana you have helped to create, is not just a Buddha field, but a pure Buddha field. Where the two traditions do agree is on the important point that the spiritual life is a common, even a cooperative venture, undertaken in unbroken association with other beings. The Buddha's repetition here, the harmonies of Buddha fields, the harmonies of Buddha fields, is an example of an idiom found also in the Pali scriptures and evidently employed for emphasis. It obviously provides a reliable way of recording emphasis both in the oral communication of the Dharma and in the written texts, Devanagari, the script used, lacking printing conventions such as capital letters, underlining, and italics. But it also seems likely that it represents the way people actually spoke. Therefore then, Subhuti, the Bodhisattva, the great being, should produce an unsupported thought, that is, a thought which is nowhere supported, a thought unsupported by sights, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables or mind objects. This refers, as Khonsa says, to apratisthita nirvana, the final nirvana of a bodhisattva, unfixed and unsupported. Although free from samsara, the bodhisattva does not settle down in nirvana and can continue to appear in the realm of samsara without belonging there in any way. We must not imagine the bodhisattva stuck in a Buddha field looking after lots of disciples. At this level, a bodhisattva is not limited in any way whatsoever, and is even able to emanate different bodies to perform different functions in different parts of the universe. The term unsupported is not to be taken too literally, however. In this context, it means not identified exclusively as this or that, not one-sided. In other words, the Buddha, or a bodhisattva of the 10th Bhumi, is not to be thought of dualistically. Hui Neng, the 6th patriarch of the Southern Zen school, recounts in the Platform Sutra how he gained enlightenment upon hearing these words. While Zen literature tends to use the word enlightenment in quite a loose, liberal way for the kind of insight that might come to you over the course of your first weekend retreat, Hui Neng's experience certainly amounted to insight with a capital I. On the other hand, it is also true to say that real insight is sustained on the basis of a number of small insights. The same small insight repeated often enough to effect the kind of change that will shift the balance of your being to the point of stream entry, by that token becomes real insight. It is like hammering at a rock until on the 20th blow it splits. The previous blows have each contributed to splitting the rock, but only if the 20th blow actually comes to be struck. So, in a way, it is difficult to determine whether an insight on its own is just an insight, or whether it is actually part of the rock-splitting process. What we can say is that for Hui Neng, it was at this point in the Diamond Sutra that the rock split.